Welcome to Nightlife, a bite-size episode.
10 years ago, just as the global financial crisis began to unfold, it would have been hard to predict that in 2018, Donald Trump would be President of the United States and that Great Britain would have voted to leave the European Union. We've seen a surge in nationalist governments and politicians across the world, an increasing polarisation on questions of migration, globalisation and international trade. While we've been more than insulated from that from here in Australia than most, with some of the political tumult being seen mostly overseas as far as we're concerned, these issues are still playing out for us as we debate, for example, the future of asylum seekers on Nauru or the signing of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Our next guest tonight has been at the forefront of all these questions for many years, from 2003 to 2006. Ian Golden was Vice President of the World Bank, and from 1996 to 2001, he was Chief Executive and Managing Director of the Development Bank of Southern Africa and served as an advisor to President Nelson Mandela. He's now a Professor of Globalisation and Development at Oxford University, no less, and his latest book is called The Age of Discovery. It argues that at the point we're at in history, with the forces of globalisation, technology and politics pulling us apart, at the same time as it's bringing the world together, actually has a lot in common with the Renaissance. And he says that history can teach us how to respond to the moment we're in. They're exciting ideas. Professor Ian Golden joins us on the program. Ian, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
It's good being on your show. Thank you.
Why, at the moment we're at now in the world, do you think it's similar to the Renaissance?
The Renaissance was a period we celebrate 500 years later of exceptional genius, of creativity, of new voyages of discovery. The Americas being discovered, many things. In fact, most of the world, except Australia, was discovered at that time by the explorers. And yet,
visited. I think it might have been news to the indigenous population of Australia that they were discovered. But
absolutely, you're absolutely right.
But Western Europeans ventured forth
world.
And explored.
Yeah, and the world went from being a flat Earth with dragons on the edge to total circumnavigation and globalization 1.0. Global commerce started, but that ended in mayhem. It ended in religious wars across Europe. It ended in jihadists effectively overthrowing the Medici's in Florence, Savonarola and his mad band of followers who led to the bonfire of the Vanities, real extremism, anti-intellectualism, fake news, and the technologies which had been used to promote the Renaissance, which were the printing press and associated technologies, were used to spread very different ideas, political pamphlets, different religions, etc. And although history does not repeat itself, it does rhyme. And we can pick up clues from how this period of accelerating change led to growing inequality, how the ships that went to the New World spread diseases that killed most Native Americans, systemic risk starting in globalization. And the lesson I take away from that is that we need to be much more effective at managing this period of change and this period of new connectivity. The financial crisis of 10 years ago was the first great systemic crisis of our age. And I do believe that not only did it lead to the collapse of many economies globally, but also gave rise to the anti-elite, anti-establishment feelings that have brought us President Trump, have brought us Brexit, and incidentally also Macron in France. And that process of where people getting left behind by change, feeling angry with elites, and the spreading of risks through connectivity, I think, are takeaways that we should get from the Renaissance as well as this most recent period of change.
Looking back in 100 years, if there was to be a Renaissance, or if you were to characterize the age we're in as having similarities to that great period of our people, when do you think it would start? Where would you put it?
I date it to almost exactly 30 years ago, 1989. What happens then is the Berlin Wall comes down and we have the beginning of an integrated global economy, the end of the Cold War. Lots of other things happen, the Uruguay round of trade negotiations, the Maastricht Treaty in Europe, capital account liberalization around the world. So politically and ideologically and economically, it's the end of the Cold War. But also, it was the same time that the World Wide Web was developed. So 89, 90 was when it was developed. And it's that, both the connectivity that came through the web and the political transformation that allowed it to happen, which I think is significant. So I would date the beginning of our second Renaissance to about then. Of course, history weaves itself across various periods of time, and we'll see how long it continues. But what you see in this period is accelerating technological change. And that's because more and more people are participating from more places in the way that things are happening.
Yeah, I think you're right to point to that, because for the first time in human history, everybody in the world can see everybody else, not just by the accounts of Marco Polo returning from distant lands and not by reading someone's account of it, but for the first time in human history, if you've got a computer connection and a screen, you can see how people live everywhere.
Yes.
If you think about it, that's an extraordinary thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is absolutely dramatic. You know, the historians tell us that about 200,000 years ago, we must probably lived in small communities in East Africa or somewhere, and people, basically humanity, was pretty tight and coherent. But then we've drifted apart across the planet since then, and it is the coming together. And of course, that's both an incredible moment of opportunity, so we should be able to understand the implications of what we do for people elsewhere. We should be much more empathetic with people around the world. But at the same time, what it seems to be doing is leading to a polarization. And it's that challenge, and we saw that in the Renaissance as well, that I think we need to manage more effectively.
The changes that you're talking about have brought great wealth to the world. We've seen countries like China, for example, in what is nothing short of an economic miracle, whatever you think of the brutal politics that lies behind it. It's brought a country from poverty into relative material wealth. Countries in our own region, like Vietnam, for example, which we would think of in the past as being poor countries, are no longer poor. In fact, by any material standard, probably more middle-class countries. India, the same. So there's been a tremendous period of wealth creation. At the same time, there's never been a dirtier word than globalization, because what you've sat there at the World Bank and others. I mean, you know, in other words, you've sat in some of the dark towers of evil, as some would say it. Why do you think that is the case? Is it simply the inequality that has come with great wealth?
I think you're absolutely right. There's never been a period of more rapid progress in human history. More people have been lifted out of poverty more quickly in more places than at any time in history. Incomes have grown, but not only incomes, life expectancies increased around the world by an average of almost 20 years over this period of time. Illiteracy has gone down dramatically. So the progress on multiple levels has been absolutely phenomenal, and that's why I believe in globalization. But at the same time, it is a dirty word, because there are three great failures in it. One is it has been associated with very rapidly rising inequality. When things change more quickly, people are being left behind more rapidly. And so what we see in all countries rapidly integrating is this rising inequality. The second great problem is the systemic risk. Integration leads to interdependency, cascading financial crises, risks of climate change, etc., cyber attacks. We are more vulnerable because we're more connected. And just like we are more subject to people's emotions when we know them better, that's happening at a global level. So we have this great problem of what I call in a previous book, the butterfly defect of globalization. And the third great problem is the commons, that because of the exceptional progress, more people are climbing the energy curve, and so we have a real risk of very catastrophic climate change. More people are consuming tuna and fish and other species, and so we have extinction of species. We are destroying the planet because of our success. And it's that tension which increasingly I think we're feeling. So as we grow more and more free, and as our incomes give us more choice, we actually need to understand that we're going to have to restrain those freedoms more as a result, if we're going to live in harmony on the planet.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think we've just had a small sideshow called a by-election here in Australia. But strangely, it actually has brought a focus on the issue of climate change in a way that previously it probably didn't have, and that there seems to be now a general view that actually people do care about this, because they have come to realise that actually something is terribly, terribly wrong. There's a report today from the World Wildlife Fund that since 1970, humans have probably killed 60% of all animal life. Now, regardless of whether that's too broad a picture, and the truth may be more slightly more complicated than that, the effect has still been quite catastrophic. There's a view almost everywhere now that something is terribly wrong, isn't there, in terms of what we might call the sustainability of this wealth creation that we've embarked upon.
Yes, something is terribly wrong. It's wrong in our societies. We're seeing it in rising inequality. We're seeing how these systemic risks are destroying lives and livelihoods. The financial crisis is a very good example of it. We're all at great risk from pandemics and other risks. And we're destroying the planet. Climate change is an absolutely potentially catastrophic thing. It really is for certain species. And of course, it's poor people in poor places that always suffer most from these risks. Rich people can move to higher ground or get air conditioning or whatever. Poor people don't have that option. So something is very wrong, and it does require us to think very deeply about the economic system, about how we restrain our freedoms, and do it in an ethical way. So a lot of the world still has to climb the energy curve. A lot of the world still has to climb the protein curve and consume better. And that, I think, in the rich countries, puts a particular responsibility on people to lead in what they're doing. Now, I've just flown here from the UK. And, of course, what we all need to get much better at, not least I do, is translating what we understand in terms of this, into changing behavior. And it's that challenge which I think we have to really surmount.
Yes, exactly. I'm talking with Ian Golden. He's Professor of Globalization and Development at Oxford University and the author of many books, and with much international experience as well. You argued a couple of years before that President Trump and Brexit were almost inevitable. These are political consequences you see of this untrammeled growth, do you?
Yes, Chris Kutana, my co-author, and I argued when we were doing Age of Discovery that both Brexit and President Trump's election were very likely to happen. Although at the time, most people thought that was neither of those things were going to happen. And the reason we felt that was because, taking the lessons from the Renaissance, we saw just how angry people get when they left behind. The dynamic cities are doing incredibly well, and a lot of the pundits and political leaders live in these dynamic cities and feel very good about change. But if you go not very far from these dynamic cities, be it London or be it San Francisco and New York, Paris, Berlin, Munich, and I don't know if the same is true here in Australia, people are really left in the past. And it's not the people who are changing rapidly that are rebelling against change. The narrative is people are rebelling against change. I think that's exactly wrong. It's the people being left behind that cannot change. You can't move to a dynamic city because you can't afford the housing prices.
That's right. That's right.
You can't get there because there's so much congestion and transport costs more. Public transport's falling apart. And so people basically have record low unemployment, record high incomes in dynamic cities, and then not very far away, people are stuck in manufacturing industries which are decaying. There's a threat of robotics and AI as well, which adds to that. And there are many factors which worry them, and not least the decline in public spending relative to their per capita incomes.
I think people see, and rightly so, that all this economic growth and all of this wealth creation is captured, and it's a fact. I mean, you would have seen from the vantage points that you've had. The fact is, most of the world's economic growth is captured by a very few people. In fact, there was an argument recently, based even here in Australia, that almost all the economic growth in recent times has been captured by a very few people. When I say a very few people, perhaps 20 people who own or control very large corporations, such as Amazon, for example, or the other fangs in the United States. So people think, this story, this narrative that I'm being told, doesn't help me, and it's ruining the planet.
Yeah, and it's ruining the planet. And they're not making it up. You know, there is a growing concentration at all levels. 20 out of 350 counties in the U.S. count for 85% of U.S. growth. In the U.K., London accounts for something like 80% of U.K. growth. The top firms, like the FANGs, Google and others, concentration of production productivity and incomes is growing. And of course, they locate offshore, a lot of them, so governments are not capturing their revenues.
But they don't pay tax. They don't seem to obey any rules.
It's not like the old firms.
No.
And that sense of something's going wrong here, and it's not benefiting me, wake up, I don't like you old elites, is very, very understandable. And we saw that happening. There are many, many places in the U.S. where people's life expectancy is lower, where their incomes are lower, where their chance of moving home is lower than their parents. And you wonder why they're angry. Yet in the cities, of course, people are doing incredibly well. And so it's that real divorce which I think we're seeing in the politics of populism. Now, I believe very strongly that what people are coming up with in remedies is profoundly wrong, because there's no wall high enough that's going to keep out climate change or pandemics, and is certainly protectionism is not going to protect jobs. It's going to lead to a smaller economy, and everyone will suffer. But at the same time, it's very important to understand what it's coming from.
Will they? Because I think this is the thing that people question very profoundly. They've always been sold the idea of economic growth, but as they've actually seen plainly, economic growth doesn't go to them. Economic growth goes to build the wealth of very few individuals. This whole trickle-down idea that if you create wealth, we all get some of it, isn't so.
Well,
it's a little bit true, but
yeah, it's more like drip down
the trickle.
The trickle is very small. Absolutely, yes, but a much smaller economy, a protected economy, is not going to provide the answer either. I mean, what is needed is a transformation of political systems which go to the old story of tax and spend. I mean, when things change more rapidly, governments have to become more active. Why? Because your education system, your health system, your infrastructure, your regulations need changing more rapidly. And if you, at the same time as you have rapid change, governments withdraw, and they don't have the means to be more active, then, of course, you get this widening disparity, and you also get increasingly out of date, and that's happening. You know, U.S. infrastructure is aging very rapidly. U.K. infrastructure is aging very rapidly. So I don't believe the answer is going to be found in protectionism and nationalism. I think the answer is going to be found in electing governments who are going to be more active and are going to ensure that we have more inclusive globalization and cohesive societies.
Why everywhere do we see a push to lower taxation on wealthy corporations? This just seems to be a form of mania amongst Western governments that everybody's in a race to have the lowest possible tax rate on corporations. Many people think, well, hang on, these corporations have captured all the wealth. Why aren't they giving it some back via taxation?
Yes, there is a race to the bottom. I think there are two or three different issues. One is globalization has led to global firms able to relocate in tax havens which have very, very preferential tax rates for them, the Cayman Islands, Monaco, places like that. And you see the registrations in this company. Secondly, these new digital firms, which don't have material production, can basically say everything is intellectual property. And they locate that intellectual property in these offshore tax havens. So you don't actually see what an iPhone or an iWatch or Amazon's real profits are and where they're coming. Mm. So we need to move to a much more revenue distribution-based and idea of taxation.
What is that?
It means that if you have a very high share of your income from a place, like Starbucks or Amazon or thing, you should be paying taxes equivalent in that place. Now, what they do is, of course, say our expenses are very high and therefore our net profits are low.
I know, but nation states have lost their autonomy in this sense because they can't do it. Because
well, there are pushbacks. And interestingly enough, the OECD has a very big initiative on this. And even the institutions like the IMF and World Bank are pushing back, which is interesting. So I think there is a capability to push back. Certainly the European Commission is right around this issue at the moment. Countries and regions have to push back on this, and we have to ensure that countries have a tax base. That's a very, very significant issue. And I think you're right. The race to the bottom is not helpful for anyone except the owners of the firms.
Mm. You've been talking here in Australia, talking about the disconnect between the economics and the politics of migration. It's a hot-button issue. It hasn't always been the case in Australia. For many years after the Second World War, migration was seen as a positive. It's probably not anymore. Well, it depends who you talk to, I suppose. But it's certainly a political issue that's in play in a way that it hasn't been. How did that come about?
I'm here for the Metropolis Conference, which is a very big annual conference of migration experts, and I'm talking about my new report, which is on economic realities and political realities and how these things don't meet and how one reconciles them. And what we find is that the economic evidence is overwhelmingly positive. Not least for Australia, which has been quite remarkable in this respect. Australia would be at least 10% poorer GDP growth if migration had been frozen about 20 years ago. So it really makes a fundamental difference in the short term, but it's also the source of all dynamism. You know, migrants are two times or three or four times as likely to start a firm, to issue a patent, to be dynamic, to even to get an Academy Award or a Nobel Prize. Migrants are truly exceptional people, and Australia's been very good about recognizing that. The political disconnect partly comes from a real disconnect in perceptions. People tend to think that they're two or three times as many migrants as they are. They tend to think that they're a burden on taxes, which they're not, because they tend to be of working age and absorb lower taxes than the rest of the population. When you ask people if they personally suffer from migration, only 20% about of people say they do, whereas if you ask them if it's a national problem, 80% say they do. So there's a disconnect between what people experience and how they feel about it nationally. And all of these things, I think, can be put down again to this new politics. We are moving from a politics which used to be mainly focused on economics to values, to people's thinking about identity and those concerns.
It's because the elites have stuffed it, haven't they? It's
because I think people do feel that those things haven't been addressed. And they, it's an interesting question. Would people feel so angry if it hadn't been for the financial crisis? I think not. There are other concerns, like income stagnating, like a sense of higher risk, which are being reflected in anti-migration policies. And, of course, the politicians and some of the media are playing their part in this. So if you ask people, why, if you don't feel bad about migrants, why do you think it's a national problem? And they say, basically, because I read about it or heard it is.
A lot of people say, look, we can't continue on this progress of economic growth. We have to find another model, and the model has got to be sustainable growth. Modern economics is not about sustainable growth. It's about getting bigger all the time. And governments talk about this all the time. We've got to increase the size of the economy all the time. There's a really fundamental belief, I think, in the community at large that this is not sustainable. We need a sustainable economics, not a growth economics. Are we anywhere close to getting there?
Economics really does need deep rethinking. And I think we've seen that in the failure to around the financial crisis and in sustainability in many other areas. And I'm actually the chair of a charity called core.econ, which is an attempt to rethink economics. So it needs fundamental rethinking. The problem with not growing is that that means you can only overcome poverty, you can only invest in infrastructure and things that you have to invest in by taking. The pie is sort of fixed size.
No, by redistributing.
Taking and giving by redistributing. And that's fine if you have enough people that have high incomes and you can politically achieve redistribution. But redistribution is much easier in a growing economy, which is one of the reasons that developing countries have much more ability when you're growing at 5, 6, 7%. Talk about China. You know, it can give without taking. So the other problem is countries that have a massive debt pile have to pay a large part of their debt back, and that requires a big budget share. So it's very difficult to both invest in the future, which means investing in education, in health, in infrastructure, and pay back debt without growing. You need extremely high taxation for that, and that's why growth keeps coming up. Now, of course, if you had low income, you have to grow just to escape low income. If you're a developing country, Australia's in a fortunate position, as many of the advanced economies are, is that you could, with a more even distribution of income, probably not grow very much. But that would require political ability to redistribute and invest in the future.
Fascinating conversation. Ian, it's been terrific to have your time, and I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.